Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime.
Hey yo.
We had some neck action going on. We were being really Valley Girl, I guess. How are you doing, Lena?
Good.
Lena brought me a shake.
Yeah, it was that kind of night.
Isn't she just a doll?
I knew you would need it.
I did need it. But you didn't bring a pack of cigarettes. So I'm like, it's kind of bittersweet. Oh, okay. You know?
Right. Sweet without the bitter.
So what's been going on with you? How was your weekend?
It went really fast. Like Sunday night, I was like getting ready for bed and I'm thinking, do I really have to work tomorrow? Yeah. So
don't they call that the Sunday scaries? Like when you can't even enjoy your Sunday because you know tomorrow is Monday.
Yeah. Yeah. But it just snuck up on me. So,
mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to hem and haw too much today. Just because we have a lot to get to in this case. This is actually going to be a two-parter. Today will be part one.
Alrighty.
There's just a lot to get to. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I will sweet potato pie and shut my mouth.
last time we got a little too crazy.
Yeah.
We talked a little too long. So here we go.
Okay.
So sometimes in our stories, we cover cases where the system works, right?
Yes.
Isn't that nice? Mm-hmm. A perp is investigated, tried, and convicted of their crime. And
I really like those. Yeah.
I do too. It makes you feel like, okay, someone died. That's horrible, but they're caught. They're serving their time.
Right. There's justice.
Justice. Mm-hmm. However, today's story will infuriate you.
Oh, no.
It's one in which the system failed us on a monumental level. It seems like at every turn, this guy somehow skirted the punishment. And in the end, it cost many, many lives.
Mm.
Sadly. We're talking about serial killer Kenneth Allen McDuff.
Oh.
Do you recognize that name at all?
I do.
Mm-hmm. So I heavily relied on a book written about his crimes called Bad Boy from Rosebud, The Murderous Life of Kenneth Allen McDuff.
Mm.
Just saying his name makes me feel gross.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a shower after this for sure. So Kenneth McDuff was born to an honest working family. Parents, John Allen, he went by J.A., and Addie McDuff in Paris, Texas on March 21st, 1946. The family relocated to Rosebud, Texas, though no one really seems to know why. They just kind of turned up in town, and the locals noticed them.
Oh, they were a little different?
They weren't warm and friendly.
Oh, gosh.
It was a small town, so they stuck out as weird, but it wasn't just a matter of judging a book by its cover. Addie ran a tight ship.
Oh.
And don't let that cute name Addie fool you at all. She really wore the pants. She ran the house, the finances, the children.
Whoa.
And everything else under that roof. She started a laundromat, which was the only one in town. So it became quite successful.
Okay.
That coupled with her husband's earnings caused them to be able to move into a nice house near the laundromat. So she was like walking distance. Now, her husband, J.A. McDuff, was a former farmer in Paris where they used to live. But now here in Rosebud, he owned and operated a concrete company. And because that was a booming industry in the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. he was a very busy guy. He was always working. It's said that he was quiet and somewhat removed from family matters, and that his only opinions were that of his wife's.
Oh no.
Maybe that was because Addie was described as really domineering. According to my text source, people around town didn't really care for her. They called her the pistol packing mama.
Because
she did carry a pistol around, and they felt like she might be responsible for some of the neighbors' dogs and cats turning up dead.
Oh no, Addie.
Yeah. They couldn't prove it though. Okay. I mean, they just kind of, you know, when you just like
she carries a gun
and suddenly, you know, all these animals are dead. They just suspected her. She could be quite threatening, like, especially when it came to her kids. So the town folk, they just avoided the family as best they could, like if they could. I do want to mention that one report I read about J.A. McDuff, the dad.
Okay.
The true crime reporter, he's actually a former news reporter. So I feel like there's some credence to this, but I also couldn't find this substantiated in any other texts that I read. So he said that J.A. was extremely abusive. To his daughters.
Oh.
He had four daughters and made the family basically watch as he would beat them and, you know, violently hurt them and humiliate them.
Oh, man.
I just think it's worth mentioning if it's true.
Right.
Because this really could explain how Kenneth came to view women the way he did. It would explain a lot to me.
Mm-hmm.
So Kenneth was one of six children, and he was babied by his mother and older sisters, actually, even though he wasn't the youngest. The word coddled was used in several reports. Even his hair-triggered, tempered father treated him better than the other siblings.
Well, what was it about him?
You know, I don't know. Maybe it's just because there's always that one kid. There's
always that one.
Mm-hmm. So he seemed to always have spending money, new clothes, and dodged rules like you would dodge a coworker on Monday morning.
Oh.
He drove this obnoxiously loud motorcycle that his mommy got him. Mommy. His ability to do what he wanted without much in the way of consequence did him no favors when it came to his emotional regulation development.
Right.
He was described as short-tempered, a bully, and just downright mean. His older brother, Lonnie, was also a jerk. They shared a lust for the tomfoolery, I guess you could say. But Lonnie's troubles, his troubling behaviors were kind of attributed to his other issues. He had learning disabilities and a speech impediment. And he, I don't know how he got this nickname, Rough Tough McDuff.
Oh.
But he would repeat it and he would say, oh. Woof Tough McDuff. And we can make fun of him because he was just an absolute garbage heap.
Oh, man.
Just like his brother. Like their mother, he also didn't like Kenneth being disciplined for stepping out of line. So much so that one time, Lonnie came at the principal, D.L. Mayo, and he was a World War II veteran.
Oh my gosh.
So he just tossed Lonnie down the stairs.
Well, I bet. He's
like, I don't think so, sir.
Yeah, not today.
Yeah.
I'm not the one.
But they did that. Kenneth could do no wrong. Even when he blatantly and obviously did something wrong, they were like, no, it wasn't him.
Oh my gosh.
Kenneth, though, would soon be put in his place at school as well. He was tall and he towered over most of the students. And I'll post pictures. He is a ghastly, he just looks mean. And especially as an adult, he looks just like the boogeyman. Kind of. But he was tall and he intimidated a lot of people. He carried himself with like an invincible air. You know, he just felt like he untouchable.
When you get what you want at all.
It's validation.
Request.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
One day, Kenneth mouthed off to the wrong person a one Tommy Sammons.
Mm.
Now, Tommy was a freshman and a really good kid. He was quiet and the teachers really liked him. He was well-rounded in athletics and academics. Mm. So he was just a good kid. Well, Kenneth called Tommy chicken shit.
No, he did not.
In front of everyone.
Uh-oh.
And Tommy stood up and got in his face. And Kenneth was like, "Wanna fight?" And Tommy was like, "Name the time and place."
Yeah, let's go.
And I bet Kenneth was like, "Oh, okay." So they met under a bridge near the school. You know, that whole meet me behind the oak tree after school?
Yeah.
Well, they did it, but it was under a bridge. But a huge crowd of students came to watch.
Oh.
And I bet everybody was expecting Tommy to get pummeled right by Kenneth. But Tommy beat the stuffing out of Kenneth.
Wow. Was he the same size as him or do we know?
He wasn't described as like bigger or anything like that. He was described as really quiet and meek and not somebody who would fight.
Okay.
But it was just like he just was not taking it that day. He just got him on the wrong day.
Yeah.
And everyone erupted in cheering and because they hated Kenneth.
Right.
He was a no good punk.
Wow.
And finally, someone had put him in his place.
Right.
So the fight was known among the students as Justice for McDuff because he was finally getting his comeuppance. And not too long after this, Kenneth dropped out of school. I think because he no longer dominated the student body. And I think that that fight also empowered students to say, well, if Tommy isn't going to take it lying down, neither are we.
We don't have to.
And maybe we're capable of fighting back as well.
Right.
So there really is so much more I could probably get into about Kenneth's background, his family, and the way he was raised. But I think Kenneth's high school principal, Mayo, summed it up best. And I'm going to read you a quote. He said, quote, "Did not get along with students, teachers, or anyone. He would lie, steal, and destroy the property of others. Was in some form of trouble every few days. He had trouble in the community for reckless driving and stealing. His family would seldom believe he did anything wrong and were always angry with the school officials and police for punishing him. His family is very unpopular in the community. This young man has been angry with the world ever since he was in fourth or fifth grade. His mother was neurotic and unreasonable. His father, not neurotic, but often unreasonable.
Oh, no.
However, the father and mother did work to provide Kenneth with all the necessities. Kenneth had the ordinary comforts as much as the average boy in this community." End quote. Wow. Addie may have loved her son, but her biggest downfall here and the thing that did him the most disservice was that she never allowed him to be held accountable.
Mm. Right.
She turned her back on his poor performance in school and blamed the teachers for not doing their job. She was in denial that he was incompetent in any way. She refused to believe he was responsible for the trouble he found himself in. And let me tell you, I think most of what will follow in this story could have been avoided had he suffered any number of the consequences that he had coming.
Right. Well, and a question that I have, I mean, I know they tried to reprimand him, but was there anyone that tried to give some kind of counseling or would he have even gone?
No. No, he had teachers that would try and take the time, but he would ignore them. He would basically laugh in their face, mock them. He was just a jerk. Like, I'm telling you, he was not going to be helped. He would do what he wanted. And
it's not like they just wrote him off. No. Like, he's just a bad kid. We need to get him out of here.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that at all. I think he put himself in that position with his repeated behavior.
Right.
All of the seemingly innocent mischief and poor self-control would go far beyond bad boy in town, and it would spiral out of control, resulting in a terrifying, unstoppable killer.
Oh, no.
Now, even though he was an absolute menace mm-hmm. who stole and vandalized property, he was caught and punished for nearly nothing in the beginning. And had that occurred, he would have had such a criminal past. You know what I mean?
Right.
He had dropped out of high school and began working with his dad in the concrete business. So I read one report that he dropped out of eighth grade and summer. The book said that he dropped out of high school. So either way, he didn't finish school. And even though his exit from school was humiliating, he certainly would never admit that.
Right.
And now he was a big boy just out there working like a man.
Right.
You know? And don't be fooled. He still had his freedoms. While everybody else his age was going to school and then coming home doing homework or participating in above board extracurricular activities, he was riding around on his motorcycle after his hardworking day, wreaking havoc and doing whatever he wanted.
Trying to see what mess he could get into.
Exactly. That's it. That's it. He was looking for a mess. Now, according to the Temple Daily Telegram, in early 1965, when he was a wee 19 years old, Kenneth was convicted of a total of 14 counts of theft.
Ooh, boy.
14 counts of theft in multiple neighboring counties. This was the first real conviction he ever suffered, even though he'd been stealing his whole life. He was sentenced to 52 years in prison.
Oh.
4 years for each of 13 of those counts. I don't know what happened to the 14th count. Maybe they dropped it. But they were to be served concurrently. So really, he only got 4 years.
I roll.
Isn't that stupid? Why bother?
Oh, my Lord.
Why bother? Oh, my gosh. Save the paperwork.
Right.
So he went to prison March 10th, 1965, and he was paroled 9 months later.
Stupid.
9 months later.
Who can I go talk to?
It gets so much worse. This is nothing. This is of no consequence. So December 29th, he was paroled. Kenneth was not fazed in the slightest.
No. Well,
with
why
that
would
little
he be?
Prison stint. He was like, psh.
Slap on the wrist.
So? I mean, the bed was uncomfortable, the food was garbage, but so? As always, he was not interested in towing the line or keeping his nose clean.
No.
He was like, no, I'm out of prison now. Now I can do whatever I want.
Mm-hmm.
Kenneth would attend these, well, they called them Bremen Street dances, but they were more like family festivals, kind of like a carnival that people from all over, like neighboring counties, would attend.
Well, that's fun.
Doesn't it sound fun?
Why don't we do that
not
anymore?
If Kenneth was there, I would not be going. Be like, oh, the McDuff kid is coming?
That's why we don't do these anymore.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably why they stopped doing them altogether. So at one of these dances, he met this guy named Roy Del Green. Roy was a follower. He was also a high school dropout, and he kind of latched on to Kenneth and sort of idolized this bad boy, reckless, I can do whatever I want reputation. No. So he's like, oh, cool. He can do whatever he wants. So Kenneth would brag to his friends about killing people, burying them in shallow graves, and he described how he had tortured women sexually.
What in the world?
And expressed how he liked all of it.
Oh my gosh.
And just a trigger warning, there is sexual assault in this episode. So
I just don't understand how that's appealing for someone to be like, oh, okay, I want to hang out with this guy. What?
Right. I think if we think back, we can all identify someone stupid that we used to know that would brag about dumb stuff.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not killing people.
No.
Not raping people.
I've never experienced that.
I haven't, but I knew other people who would like brag, like just lie. And
right.
It's the pathology. He just was pure, absolute evil.
Right.
So that's what flowed through his pathways. Not,
yeah.
Oh, I used to be a colonel in the military, you know, like a wild tall tale.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he wasn't lying about anything great.
Quite the opposite.
Exactly. His friends, especially Roy Dale, his new friend, didn't believe a word of it. They just was like, okay, Kenneth.
Yeah.
Again, what makes someone think that someone who's joking about killing somebody is just joking? I don't know.
Yeah.
They maybe thought he was capable of doing it, but they didn't think he'd actually done any of what right. he was talking about. But that would change one fateful, steamy August night in 1966. It was a Saturday, and Roy Dale was working with Kenneth and Kenneth's dad and brother on a concrete job in Temple. And they were just buzzing because they had plans to go out to Fort Worth that night. Funky town.
Yeah.
For days leading up to this, Kenneth had been feeding Roy these wild tales about killing people, raping women, and just being like, yeah, I can't wait. I'm going to find somebody. And Roy was 18. He hung on every word, but still didn't think he was serious about any of it.
Oh my gosh.
He just was like, yeah, okay.
Ew.
So they finished up work in Temple early that afternoon and went back to Kenneth's house to get cleaned up. As much as you can clean up to just miscreants mm-hmm. before heading on their two-hour trip to Funky Town, Fort Worth. They cruised the open road in Kenneth's Dodge, stopping off at a 7-Eleven to get some beer. Not Slurpees, beer. Mm-hmm. And they enjoyed that the rest of the ride, as you do on the open road. And when they got to Fort Worth, they picked up another six-pack. I don't know that they had any set plans. You know, when you're just like, yeah, let's go to Fort Worth, like, or let's go downtown. Mm-hmm. And you don't really have a plan. You just want to go downtown, see what you get up to.
Yeah, yeah. Where's the party at?
Yeah, see where the wind blows you. Well, Kenneth drove by this place called Helen's Bar, where he saw someone he knew. So he stopped there. They went over to that friend's house, and he'd actually dated this guy's sister, so he knew her as well. So he was going over there to see her.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And they decided to do a little drive around town in Everman. These are all places that are like, you know, 20 minutes
yeah.
from each
An
other.
Easy drive.
Yeah, just easy drives around town. And really, it was all as innocent as it sounds up until that point, which is probably why Roy was like, this is normal. He's not killing anybody up until that point.
Oh.
And nobody had any idea it was coming. He would say to Roy, let's go find some girls. I know just where to go.
Oh, do you?
Mm-hmm. So they headed to the baseball field at Everman High School because Kenneth, as they drove by, he saw a car parked out in the field and he thought a couple was probably quote unquote parked
okay,
out right. there, which is what they did back in the 60s.
Went parking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
On the weekends. Now, according to the book, he positioned his car about 150 yards away before making his move. The car parked in the field was a 1955 Ford. And inside were three teenagers, 17-year-old Robert Brand, 15-year-old Marcus Dunham, and 16-year-old Edna Louise Sullivan. They're sitting, laughing, talking. Edna, at one point, who went by Louise, she pulled out her mascara and wrote her name, Louise, on the window.
Aww.
Just, you know, teenage stuff. Now, Robert Brand was born June 26, 1949, and my goodness, he was a cutie. Woo! Just to look at him, you would imagine a line of girls wrapped around his street. Okay. But his heart belonged to Louise.
Oh.
That was his girl. He lived in Alvarado, Texas with his parents. He loved music. He was in a band sometimes. You know, he'd get with groups of students and play. He'd actually worked all these little odd jobs to scrape enough money together to buy a guitar. Then he was so proud of it.
Aww.
Now, his cousin Marcus was visiting from California. Marcus was actually from Texas, but his family had moved to California. And he was actually staying the summer with Robert and his family. And they were thick as thieves. They were cousins.
Yeah.
You know, we're more like sisters, I think. They were more like brothers. And they shared a love for outdoors and music. Marcus actually played the drums and was in a band from time to time as well. Louise was 16. She was going to be starting her junior year the following year. And she was really excited. She had already had her career picked out.
Wow.
She was lovely. She was beautiful. She did really well in school. That night, they had actually planned a double date with Louise and her friend Rhonda. But Rhonda had this, I don't know, she got this weird feeling because Marcus was at his grandmother's house before this whole night and he hitchhiked to Robert's house.
So that freaked her out.
And she was just like, ew, he hitchhiked?
He doesn't have his own car.
And so she was like, I feel sick. I can't go. So she pretended to be sick to stay home. And I bet she thanked her lucky stars.
Yeah.
Every day of her life that she stayed home that night.
Oh, no.
So Kenneth, back in his Dodge, grabbed his brother's revolver, which was in the center console of his car, opened the door, and told Roy to grab the stick out of the back seat. You see, he'd been riding around for weeks with this long, broken broomstick in his back seat.
Just in case he needed it.
Just waiting for the perfect time to use it, I guess. Kenneth crept up on Robert's car, totally just expecting to find a couple making out in there. But he was surprised to see two guys and a girl. Roy, who was standing a bit back closer to Kenneth's car, saw a noticeable shift in Kenneth's stance, I guess. And so he kind of
paused,
was like, oh, I got to go see what's going on. So he kind of quickly walked towards Kenneth. And it was at that point that Kenneth had the kids at gunpoint.
Oh.
He had pulled out the gun, pointed it at them, and told them all to get out of the car.
Oh, wow.
He
How
took terrifying. The two boys. I can't even imagine. He took the two boys' wallet and opened the trunk of Robert's car and ordered all three of them to get inside of Robert's trunk. After he rifled through the wallets, Kenneth realized these young men didn't have any money. Maybe they had a few bucks in there, enough to go see a movie or get, I don't know, a hamburger or something. But it wasn't enough to rob them over. So he had to shift gears. He told Roy to get in the car. So he drove Robert's car back to his car, Kenneth's car, and told Roy, follow me in my car. So they drove further into the countryside, down gravel roads, through pastures. Kenneth was looking for a discreet place to commit his crime. They came up on FM 1017, a small farm road in Burleson, and pulled into the field off the road. Now, I'm not sure why he chose this place, because he had stopped at a place previous and was like, no, 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 not this place. We're going to go over here. But he chose this place, and a car drove by. There was a house just 400 yards away. And the lady that lived at that house later would testify in court that she saw two cars pull into the field about 10:35 p.m. that night.
Interesting.
So I don't know why he decided that. But anyways, they turned the cars off, which in turn shut off all the lights on both cars off this isolated road. And when they opened the trunk where the kids were being held, those terrified eyes looked upon two devilish shadows.
Yeah.
I mean, they probably couldn't see a thing. Kenneth pulled Louise out of the car and she quietly complied. Roy put her in the trunk of Kenneth's car and shut the lid. Once Louise was secured, Kenneth turned to Roy and said, they got to look at me. I'm going to have to kill him.
Wow.
And like every other time, Roy says he didn't believe him.
Get over it. Just admit.
Even though they had just abducted three people.
Right. Come on now.
Even though Kenneth had a gun and they had driven these kids out to a desolate pasture, he still says he didn't believe him.
I'm not buying it.
And before Roy could take one more breath, Kenneth was firing that gun into the trunk. The boys were flailing, trying to get out of the trunk, begging for their lives. But Kenneth just kept shooting. Robert was struck twice, once in the ear, once in the forehead. And as Marcus waved his arms to try and block the shots, Kenneth grabbed him by the hair and shot him point blank in the head.
Oh, my
Lord. Roy freaked out. He's like, why? Why did you just do that?
Dude, that's what he planned on the whole time.
That's what he's been saying this whole time. And Kenneth looked at him calmly and said, had to be done. So they get back in the Dodge and they began driving. Don't forget Louise is in the trunk.
Right.
And trigger warning here for the next series of events. They drove for a little bit and made it to a small town called Egan. Found another rural patch of road, FM 917, and they drove through this tall grass and Kenneth stopped the car. He opened the trunk and ordered Louise to get out and into the back seat of his car. Mm. Roy exited the car and Kenneth raped Louise. It is said that he raped her with the broomstick.
Oh my gosh.
And himself. But when he was done violently assaulting her, he encouraged Roy to take a turn. How sick.
Yeah. So encouraged.
Well, the way Roy tells it, he didn't want to. He said, you know, I said no, but I was scared of Kenneth.
Right.
So he's like, I tried and then I couldn't get it up. But then he did. He did. He was able to rape her.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Sadly, the worst part was not over for Louise, the poor girl. This poor girl. They drove a short distance further. Kenneth got Louise out of the car and sat her in front of the car. At first, she was like, what are you going to do? Like, what are you going to do with me? He's like, oh, I'm going to tie you up and leave you here. And she was like, why? We're in the middle of nowhere. Like, why would you tie me up? It's not like I'm going anywhere.
Right.
He turned and went to his car, retrieved the broomstick, and walked toward Louise. Before she could probably realize what was actually happening, he had pushed her down and ordered Roy to hold her legs. And he sat on her chest and he pressed the broomstick to her neck. Harder and harder until her neck broke. And he even held it there longer than he needed to, just to make sure she was dead. He wanted to shoot her, just to really make sure she was dead.
Should have just done that in the first place. Like, why torture her anymore? Yeah.
Well, he realized that he had used all the bullets on the boys. So he had Roy help him lift her body over a fence and drag her to some nearby trees to try and hide her body. He took the cross necklace that she was wearing, put it in his pocket, and they souvenir. Left. Mm-hmm. I feel like I was there. Like,
yeah, I don't just, like that. I don't.
It
put me back somewhere else because I don't like that.
I know, but at the same time, I'm almost like, I want to be there with her because only she was alone. Only
if I can save her.
I know. It's just, it breaks my heart that she was alone. Kenneth and Roy were like, okay, time to go home. So they began their drive back to Roy's house. What do you reckon two murderers talk about on a long car ride?
Well, for one who doesn't seem to comprehend reality.
Yeah.
What probably is he freaking out? Is he...
Well, Kenneth used much of the time to tell Roy he better not breathe a word of any of this or he'd be sorry. I bet he thought, yeah, I believe you. I believe you now.
Yeah.
So they tossed out the broomstick on the way, the spent shells from Lonnie's gun. remember Lonnie as Kenneth's brother. Mm-hmm. They even stopped and buried Robert and Marcus's wallet. Like, they just pulled over on the side of the road and dug a hole and buried their wallets. They got to Roy's house, and in the wee hours of Sunday morning, Kenneth buried the gun near the garage, and then they cleaned out the car. And he prepared for a date that he had later that day. You know, just standard stuff.
Yeah.
Now, back in Alvarado, Robert's mom was getting worried because her son and her nephew weren't back yet. When Robert's dad, Jack, returned home from work at 2:15 a.m., he worked the night shift, or the, what is it, second or third shift, whatever it is.
Yeah.
She was really in a panic. She's like, okay, now I know it's really late. Now, Jack grabbed his keys and set right back out. He drove for hours, hours. And then he finally returned home just like about to pass out, exhausted.
Yeah.
And he thought maybe Robert and Louise ran off and got married. Who knows?
Oh, man.
I mean, you know, he's just thinking. Robert was really reliable. He always came home.
Yeah.
He always called. So they just thought maybe he did something wild, but they were worried. Now, meanwhile, Louise's parents thought she was spending the night with Rhonda. Remember, Rhonda was supposed to go on that double date. Well, Louise was supposed to stay at Rhonda's house that night. So Louise's mother was not expecting her home.
Yeah, none the wiser. Mm-mm.
And it wasn't until later that day that she realized and found out, in fact, Louise did not stay with Rhonda and that Louise was missing. So early the morning of Sunday, August 7th, 1966, a man named Bill Sanders was driving down FM 1017 when he saw a Ford parked out in the field with its trunk open. That didn't look right to him.
Yeah.
He's like, So he pulled over to make sure everything was okay. And that's where he discovered the two teenage boys dead in the trunk of the car.
And how long was this?
Just the next morning.
The next morning.
Yeah. So they were killed 10, 11 o'clock. And this was early the next morning. So he hightailed it to the nearest house, which was Miss McAllister's house, 400 miles away. The lady who saw the two cars park out in the field at 10:30 the night before. Well, they called police. Police descended on the crime scene. And they were pretty quickly able to piece together who they were looking at. The book I read about this case isn't clear about the details of how the identifications were made by police or who found out what and when. But what it does say is that Rhonda's mother is the one who informed the Brand family that the boys were found. Remember, Rhonda is the one who didn't go.
Right.
So I don't know how she found out. Maybe she had a police scanner. Who knows?
Or a friend in the police force.
Yeah, who knows? Burleson Fire Chief Charles Newby, just had to throw that in there because that was our granddad's name, helped to recover the teens' bodies from the trunk. Robert's father, Jack Brand, arrived to identify his son and his nephew's bodies. And after some conferring with police, realized that Louise was supposed to be with the two boys. So where was she?
Mm-hmm.
Police realize now they have a missing person. They've got two dead and a missing person. So police, along with about 250 volunteers, trekked the adjacent fields, roadways, ditches, ponds, whatever they could do on foot at that time, looking for the missing girl. By the next day, helicopters, horses, and motorcycles were used to widen the search. But they didn't find her. They didn't find her until they had some help. Roy Dell Green.
Oh, he came forward on his own?
Hmm.
Is that what you're going to tell me?
Yeah. So Kenneth had taken Roy over to his friend Richard's house and dropped him off there. So he could go on his date, you know?
Okay.
That Sunday. When Roy went into Richard's house, Richard and his girlfriend could just see that Roy was not okay.
Oh my gosh.
He just looked visibly shaken. So they were like, let's go for a drive. They all piled into Richard's car, took a little drive. Roy was sitting in the back seat and just started crying. And the couple probably looked at each other like, okay,
what's going on
with him? Yeah. And that's when a news flash came over the radio.
Oh my gosh.
Two bodies had been found in the trunk of a car in Tarrant County. And Roy just collapsed into the seat and began to sob.
Oh.
At this point, Richard pulled the car over because he's like, come take a walk with me. What's going on, man? I think he was a really good man for doing that because he comforted Roy.
Yeah.
And Roy felt comfortable to spill the beans.
Yeah.
And he did. He confessed the whole thing, everything that had happened the night before. They headed back to Richard's house. Then they went to Roy's house, and Roy's mother encouraged him to turn himself into the police.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
So Sheriff Sonny Elliott picked up Roy Dale and took him to the station to be booked and learned even more details about the events that had transpired the night before. Some police don't think of it this way, but time is of the essence mm-hmm. when you're talking about gathering evidence. So they wanted to recover as much evidence as they could. You know, the broomstick was never found. The boys' wallets were never found. But they tried to go get that gun that was buried at Roy's house.
Oh, right.
But when they got there, it was gone. So they drove Roy back to the station to get, I guess, a formal statement at this point. Now, very quickly, the media got hold of the fact that they already had someone in custody for the murders, even though the third victim still hadn't been found at that point. Police could see that Roy was crumbling, and they knew him to be a pest. I mean, he was known in the around town to be a jerk, but not a violent killer. So they believed him initially when he said that Kenneth is the one that executed the crimes, especially after they took a look at Kenneth's rap sheet. Now, remember, they're in a different county at this point, so they don't know Kenneth like Rosebud knows Kenneth.
Okay, gotcha.
Now they're looking for Louise and Kenneth Allen McDuff.
Yeah.
So the search parties were still on foot out there in the blistering Texas heat. Let me just tell y'all something about August Texas heat.
Yeah.
It's a no from me, dog.
Well, you're going to be here, okay?
So these people were out there in the tall grass. Snakes sweating through every piece of their clothes.
Oh, yeah.
And they were getting so frustrated because heat makes you mad. Yeah. Also,
sure does.
But they couldn't find Louise, and they couldn't find anything to do with these crimes or anything that would even remotely.
So Roy didn't tell them where the wallets were, or he couldn't remember.
He couldn't remember. And I'll get into that in a minute. You're also probably thinking, why didn't Roy just take them to her body?
Yes.
Okay. Well, he didn't remember where it was.
It was dark.
He'd never been to Fort Worth before until that night. He was almost useless in aiding the police. Almost useless. He remembered seeing a sign for Burleson as they drove. So there was that. They had taken Roy out a couple times in the Burleson area. He's like, no, this isn't it. This doesn't look right. And he was getting frustrated. The police were getting frustrated. Someone ended up saying, here, can you draw it out on a napkin? And he did.
Okay.
He was able to visualize. And then they realized they should be looking further north in Johnson County.
Ah.
And after some driving around, they finally reached a tall grassy field with a fence, and Roy lit up. This looks like it, he said.
Oh.
He jumped the fence, you know, the fence I told you they lifted her over and then drug her to the trees.
Okay.
He was like, I know she's here somewhere. He jumped the fence. He's looking around, but there were trees, there were shrubs and bushes. Nobody could see anything just like out in the, you think of a field, how can you not find a body in a field?
Yeah.
But it was shrubs and overgrown grass. And I mean, she was so hidden back there. He got really frustrated because he couldn't find her. So they took Roy back to the station, but a group of officers stayed back to do a more thorough search.
Okay.
And they found her. They found her.
Ugh.
She was very well hidden in some tall grass under some oak trees. There she was, all by herself. You know who wasn't hidden in tall grass? Although he should have been, because he's a snake.
Right.
Kenneth McDuff.
Mm-hmm.
Roy told investigators just where to find him. He's like, oh yeah, he's going on a date with this girl named Joanne. So they waited at Joanne's house for Kenneth to drop her off.
Saved her life, probably.
Shoot. Can you imagine? She lived in Bremond, and about 10:50, they see Kenneth pulling into the driveway. But uh-oh, Kenneth saw them hiding in the bushes.
Oh my gosh.
So he reversed his car and sped away. Now, Sheriff Elliot fired off some buckshot at Kenneth's car. He hit the tire, the radiator, as Kenneth drove away, and a chase ensued. Now, Kenneth somehow, I don't know if he turned the corner real quick and hopped in another car, but he gets in this other car and tells these other people to drive.
Oh, no.
Yeah, this is like a movie. But police quickly tracked him down and ordered them out of the car and took him into custody. Now, the joint funeral for the cousins, Robert Hugh Brand and Johnny Marcus Dunham, took place at First Baptist Church in Alvarado, and they were buried side by side in the Glenwood Cemetery in Alvarado.
My heart.
If we were murdered together, I hope that we would be buried side by side.
I would think our family would do that. But that's not going to happen. Us. Oh.
I mean, I prefer to be cremated, but
yeah,
I would be honored to be buried next to you. Edna Louise Sullivan was buried in Godley Cemetery in Godley, Texas. So if you're ever in the area, go pay your respects.
Okay.
You know? Now, though the teenagers had finally been laid to rest, multiple counties in North Texas were still reeling over the tragedy as Kenneth McDuff's trial got underway in late 1966. Talk about a speedy trial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he denied killing the teens, saying that Roy was the mastermind behind the slayings. He refused to talk. He lawyered up right away. At trial, the jury heard all the evidence, which included Kenneth's criminal past, and they could see for themselves his black eyes and pure evil soul.
Because normally these days you don't get to put in the past criminal history into the trials. So
yeah, Addie McDuff made a scene in the courtroom.
Of course she did.
She even threatened Robert Brand's family.
What is wrong with this woman?
And both of his parents denied his involvement as well.
Lord.
Roy Del Green testified as to his involvement in the murders, but told the court in detail Kenneth's fixation with rape and murder. Roy Del Green pled guilty to his involvement in the murders and got 25 years.
Oh.
Kenneth Allen McDuff was found guilty by the jury of his peers for all three murders and is sentenced to death by electric chair, affectionately named Old Sparky by us Texans. But.
Yeah, I knew there was a butt coming. That's why I'm like, I'm over here holding my forehead.
I could see the confusion on your face. That's not the end of the story.
No.
I wish it was. Kenneth approached his execution date in 1969 and then the following year in 1970. However, each time he was granted stays. You know, it takes a long time to execute someone, even by today's standards.
Right.
So he was spared for a couple more years. Then in 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court abolished the death penalty. So Kenneth's death sentence, along with the other 87 people on death row at the time, his sentence was overturned and commuted to life.
Mm.
He came before a parole board in 1980 and tried bribing them to let him out. He's like, I can give you $10,000. My parents have the money.
Ooh, $10,000.
So one of the board members said something to the effect of, thank you, we'll take that into consideration, before he was sent back to his cell and charged with bribery.
Okay.
Needless to say, at that time, his parole was denied. Now, that bribery charge was eligible for an additional life sentence.
Oh,
wow. To be tacked on to his existing life sentence. But somehow, his new attorney wrangled him out of that. Throughout Kenneth's stint in prison, his family had lawyers on his case. Can you believe it? Can you believe this? These people? Now, at this time, Dallas attorney Gary Jackson was on Kenneth's case, and he did a really good job. Like, he was a good attorney for the wrong person, but he was a good attorney. So he managed to get him an evidentiary hearing in 1982, claiming that he had new evidence to prove that Roy Del Green was the real murderer.
No.
It didn't work out. Ugh. The court said, there's not enough for new trial. Nice try, though. Now, we don't tend to parole dangerous people here in Texas, but in October of 1989, that's exactly what happened. Despite Kenneth's criminal history and murder convictions, the parole board head, I'm going to say his name, Bill Clements, was making it possible for inmates to be paroled right and left because of the overcrowding in the prisons.
Okay, but can we check out their crimes before we do that, please? Oh my gosh.
I'm going to get into that. Now, this, well, mistake doesn't exactly cover it, but because of this monumental lapse in judgment by the parole board, we'd eventually find our way to our slogan, "Don't mess with Texas."
Okay.
The events that followed Kenneth's release made lawmakers take a good hard look in the mirror and realize that Texas had a very broken criminal justice system, and that this revelation would give rise to a new, more intolerant justice system in the state of Texas.
Well,
that's because Kenneth killed again and again and again. And that's where I'm going to leave you for part one.
Ugh.
I know that was a long one. You do not want to miss part two. We're just getting started here.
Yeah. Well, that was hard to sit through. That was hard to hear all of that you shared. And bless their hearts.
It's rough. It's rough. I've been researching this case for a while. I've come back to it a couple times. Mm-hmm. I haven't wanted to tell it because it's rough.
Yeah.
These poor teenagers and the rest of his victims,
their life mattered.
Oof.
They were going places.
They were. The destruction he caused is just vast.
I can't understand it.
So make sure you come back next week for part two.
I'll be here. Okay. Well, that was great. We'll do it again next week.
Yeah. We'll see you next week, guys.
Bye, y'all.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please consider leaving us a positive review and rating. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to our show.
You can also follow us on Instagram at Cousins on Crime Podcast, or send case suggestions to cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.